Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the humanitarian disaster in Syria brought on by the Assad government's deliberate policy of starving its own population under siege in Homs, Aleppo, and parts of Damascus. Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver and co-author of The Syria Dilemma, joins us to discuss his article in the New York Times, Use Force to Save Starving Syrians, and efforts underway to deliver food and allow civilians to escape that has resulted in the detention by the Assad regime of hundreds of men and boys who the United Nations aid agencies are deeply concerned about. Then we'll examine the catastrophic ice storms hitting the south in the context of increasingly extreme weather events happening across the globe. Peter Ward, a paleontologist who teaches biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington, joins us. He has studied mass extinctions, almost all of which have been brought about by climate change, and his latest book is The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps, which we will discuss along with the connections between extreme droughts in Australia, floods in England, and ice storms in Atlanta, Georgia. Then finally, we'll speak with the author of a new book that reads like a nail-biting thriller, but is in fact a definitive account of the Fukushima disaster, from the tsunami to the nuclear catastrophe, which continues to this day with areas of the devastated plant no human can go near, as every day hundreds of tons of water pour on to cool the melted cores, and radioactive water crosses the Pacific from Japan to Malibu, California, where the kelp beds are being measured for radiation. One of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power, who formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, David Lochbaum, the co-author of Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster, joins us to discuss his terrifying account of a very real event that could happen here. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School for International Studies at the University of Denver. He is the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards the Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book is The Syria Dilemma, and he has an article at the New York Times with Danny Postel, Use Force to Save Starving Syrians. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
And some 800,000 civilians are currently under siege in areas around the cities of Homs, Aleppo, and in parts of Damascus. And this is a deliberate policy on the part of the Assad regime. These are what they call starvation sieges, where people are subsisting on grass and weeds. And the UN has recently been able to get some people out, but they have been subject to sniper fire and mortar attacks. And then with the groups that they've gotten out, some 300 men and boys have been detained. What do we know about the fate of them?
Well, we don't have exact information, but anyone who is familiar with the human rights record of Assad will realize and should realize that they're not faring very well. Most likely they're being tortured, most likely they're being beaten, most likely they're going to end up dead. And this is, I think, just highlights the tragedy of the conflict in Syria, the tragedy of what we've been witnessing for the last 3 years, and the complete failure of the international community to really do anything seriously and substantively to intervene, to alleviate the suffering of the Syrian people.
Well, on Monday, Russia and China failed to attend a meeting in New York of the UN Security Council, which was the French are trying to get a resolution together calling for greater access for humanitarian aid to these starving, besieged populations. When you, in the New York Times, along with your co-author Danny Postel, talk about the use of force to save starving Syrians, that, of course, will inevitably come up against a Russian and or a Chinese veto, which has been the record so far.
That's correct. There's a longer history here. You know, there was a presidential statement, which is sort of a weaker sort of type of document that the UN Security Council sometimes issues. Back in October, this issue of the humanitarian crisis that was, emerging then, winter was coming, and, the Security Council got together and tried to sort of discuss this issue. And at the time, Russia strongly opposed any sort of forceful resolution that had teeth. that would sort of try and, you know, suggest some sort of coercive measures to make sure that people can eat. And at the time they said, look, now is not appropriate. I'm talking about October. The Russians insisted it was inappropriate to sort of talk about anything serious, forceful, and substantive. Just on the this past weekend, when a draft resolution began to be circulated once again, dealing with the question of the humanitarian crisis in Syria, Russia again objected in saying that, look, now is not the time. One has to ask, you know, Vladimir Putin and the Russian team at the United Nations, well, when is the appropriate time? I mean, the big difference between October, when this issue was first raised, and Russia vetoed any serious attempt to intervene, and today, when they are again vetoing and obfuscating any international action on Syria, the difference is that tens of thousands of Syrians have died in the interim. And that is the consequence of, I think, Vladimir Putin's really morally obscene posture toward the crisis in Syria. And so Danny and I wrote a piece over the weekend saying, look, Vladimir Putin needs to be challenged, and whether tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Syrians are able to eat or not should not be dependent on the whims and wishes of Vladimir Putin and his ally in Damascus.
But already, of course, there was a threat of force over the use of chemical weapons. At the last minute, President Obama reversed himself, and that became the basis of then followed a Russian and Iranian brokered deal to get rid of Assad's weapons, which everybody's celebrated, including Secretary of State and President Obama. However, we learn that only 4% of these chemical of Assad's arsenals have been accounted for. So that deal, it looks like we've been had on that deal, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there was a state. There was an unconfirmed sort of, you know, off the record report last week that Secretary of State John Kerry, in a meeting with several of his colleagues in the Senate, where he used to work, has sort of come forward and said, you know, if you put it all together, international policy on Syria, U.S. policy on Syria has been a failure. One has been this whole question of chemical weapons. About 5% have been removed from the country. On top of that, it's pretty clear to anyone who has eyes that the Geneva process is not going to go anywhere because of its inherent structural flaws. And now we have sort of the spread of Al-Qaeda throughout a large chunk of Syria and in the Middle East, posing a major security threat, not only to, you know, the region, but now increasingly to Europe and the United States, as revealed and indicated in several statements over the last week by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, and also the head of Homeland Security. So you put it all together, it's a disaster that is getting worse by the day. And I think the chemical weapons deal that was celebrated was just, as we can see now looking back, really just a distraction, because it didn't deal with the root causes of the Syrian conflict. It actually strengthened Assad. This is going to continue until there's a shift in policy, which is why we were motivated to sort of write this op-ed piece to sort of suggest, look, you know, we may not be able to sort of at this moment deal with the complexities of a political settlement in Syria, but surely the world can come together and agree on sort of a basic moral right that people should have the right to eat, to feed themselves. And if Assad is going to deny hundreds of thousands of his own citizens the right to eat, well, then the international community should use coercive measures to break these sieges, to break these blockades, and to challenge Assad's kneel or starve policy.
Again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School for International Studies at the University of Denver. His latest book is The Syria Dilemma, and he has an article at the New York Times with Danny Postel, Use Force to Save Starving Syrians. But I think surely, though, given what happened with President Obama reversing himself and the bizarre statements from Secretary Kerry suggesting that the punitive strikes against Assad for using chemical weapons against his own population would be, I think, incredibly small, I think, to quote what he said. We know from that period the Joint Chiefs were not happy about it. The U.S. military is weary. They've been in two losing wars. They've gotten out of one in Iraq, and they're getting out of another one in Afghanistan. The American people are weary. I think the Congress was pretty reluctant. I think the president saw that and decided to bring them in on it, and then at the last minute cancel these incredibly small attacks. So just looking at the idea that somebody's going to come to the rescue of the Syrian people, it just is pretty bleak, isn't it? I mean, what leads you to think? I mean, maybe Obama and Hollande are talking about it in this state visit of the French president, since the French seem to be the ones that are outraged about what's happening. But I don't see the American people particularly concerned about the fate of Syrians.
No, you're right. They haven't been concerned, but I think there are new developments since the chemical weapons attack and the major debate that we had in this country on Syria, you know, last August, early September. And I think one of the big, you know, changes, number one, is that the humanitarian crisis has gotten much worse. Approximately 40% of Syria's population are internally displaced, or they've been turned into refugees. Over 100,000 people, according to the most conservative estimates, have been killed. You know, there's now sort of, to quote the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nabi Pelli, there's, quote, massive evidence that points direct finger to the highest levels of the Syrian regime for perpetrating state-sanctioned war crimes and crimes against humanity. There was those photographs that were smuggled out of Syria showing industrial-scale killings and tortures within Syria's prison system, and now there's a starvation crisis. So the moral and ethical stakes at the heart of the Syrian conflict have always been there. They've gotten worse. People can see it. But on top of that, now Syria, as I indicated before, has become a security crisis, an emerging security crisis for the world, particularly for the Western world. Al-Qaeda now, according to one leading Al-Qaeda expert, you know, controls a swath of territory in the heart of the Middle East that stretches 400 miles wide. Europe is very concerned about the fact that there are now over 1,000 young marginalized Muslim men who have left various European countries to join radical Islamist groups. What will happen when they go back? There was an article in the New York Times how the Syrian conflict is now resonating and affecting Indonesia for similar reasons. The leaders of the American intelligence communities and Homeland Security Department are now sort of sounding the alarm bell, saying, look, as a direct result of the Syrian conflict, we are seeing this emerging threat that is a big concern. And so perhaps people in Washington who haven't been and never really were persuaded by the ethical and moral stakes at the heart of the Syrian conflict might be willing to take a second look at this tragedy because of the direct threat that Syria is now posing to Western security interests. I'm talking about threats within the homeland here in the United States and in Europe. So I think from that perspective, there is new developments that might force the international community to take the Syrian conflict take a much more seriously, because as I said, it's not simply about Syria and the Middle East today. Now it's affecting the entire world.
But now, Ashmi, the Saudis apparently have had second thoughts about their funding these jihadis and allowing their own citizens to go. They've just passed a law against anybody going off to fight jihad in Syria. And they appear to actually be genuinely concerned about blowback, even though they've been cynically exporting their jihadis for decades, and they did so in Afghanistan. Turkey's leader is preoccupied with domestic problems he has. He sort of lost his zeal, I think, for intervention. And as I say, the U.S. doesn't seem to want to do anything. And only France seems to be concerned. I'm just wondering if there is a, you know, something deeply cynical going on here, that everybody's just sort of waiting for these people to exhaust each other Meanwhile, if you can look at the photographs of what's happening, apart from the humanitarian, the disgraceful humanitarian situation, which, you know, should be getting the world's attention. If you just look at pictures, these cities are devastated. I mean, this country is being destroyed before our eyes.
You're right. I think there has been an unstated sort of attitude among many people, particularly within the Obama administration, and particularly Obama himself, an almost deep desire to see the Syria conflict move away, wither away. Obama has wanted to, according to his stated positions, to pivot to Asia. When he looks at Syria, he looks at Syria through the prism of Iraq. So do a lot of American citizens. That's completely understandable. But I think those two conflicts are very different, and I think the solutions to how one can and should deal with those two countries are very different. But the point here is that despite the desire after 3 years to hope that Syria will go away, Syria keeps dragging the entire world back to its territory, and including President Obama, to think that this is simply going to solve itself and not affect the region, which it clearly is. All of the neighboring countries are destabilized, but now it's becoming a security problem for the entire world. So I think that demands a serious engagement with the question of Syria. I think fundamentally, until the United States decides to shift policy, I don't see the countries that you mentioned, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, or any other regional countries paying attention or doing anything substantively or constructive in terms of trying to solve the conflict. The Geneva process is effectively a joke. No one takes it seriously, largely because the inherent structural flaws in Geneva sort of presuppose that Assad is going to send his team to Geneva to negotiate his own disempowerment. That's not going to happen unless there's a changing set of factors on the ground, changing battlefield conditions that will force, I think, Assad and his side to negotiate much more seriously. So you're right, it doesn't look good. But the more that the world sort of just stands on the sidelines, the more the humanitarian crisis gets worse. And the security crisis, as we're now seeing, according to the leaders of the American intelligence community, is now starting to affect directly the security of Europe and the security of the United States. So perhaps for this latter reason, I'm hoping that there's going to be a recognition that, taking seriously, challenging the Russian position on Syria is in America's national interests. It's not simply a question of ethics and morality, but this is something that has to be dealt with in a much more serious way. And hoping and wishing that it'll go away is not a policy. It's wishful thinking, and it's not going to happen. So I think for all of those reasons, it's pretty clear in the report that I just mentioned that Secretary Kerry himself, one of the architects of U.S. policy in Syria, according to recent reports, has given up and has admitted defeat. So that, I think, suggests a deeper soul searching within the heart of the Obama administration. It remains to be seen whether anything will happen, but it's pretty clear that ignoring Syria and hoping that it'll go away is not going to solve this problem.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Nader Hashemi.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. And his latest book is The Syria Dilemma. And he has an article at the New York Times with Danny Postel, Use Force to Save Starving Syrians. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the catastrophic ice storms hitting the south in the context of increasingly extreme weather events happening across the globe. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Ward, who's a paleontologist who teaches biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. He has published widely on biodiversity and the fossil record and is an expert on mass extinctions. His award-winning books include Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere, and Under a Green Sky, which pointed out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought about by climate change, the same global warming that occurs today. His latest book is The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Ward.
Well, thanks for having me again. It's really been a pleasure in the past.
And Peter, we always talk about catastrophic weather, and here we are being warned now that Atlanta is being hit by a catastrophic second blow from a huge ice storm that stretches all the way from Texas to Virginia. How do we put this in the context of global warming?
Well, I remember just recently in the State of the Union, President Obama did mention global warming, but there was, I think, hoots and boos when he even brought it up because we were in that record cold. And yet, how short-sighted are our politicians? Why don't they at least look to California, which is perhaps in 3 years of drought, one of the greatest droughts in history there? But go down the other side, down under to Australia, where they're not only in years of drought, but they're having heat that's higher than any time in history. Secondly, I've been working in the Philippines this past year, and they had the greatest single typhoon season, typhoons are hurricanes, of course, in their history. And yet, again, the deniers say that because we didn't have many hurricanes this year that there's no global warming. I mean, it's really unfortunate. You've got, as the atmosphere warms, more water vapor goes up into it, and that precipitates out. Plus, you've got crazy weather. Everybody sees this. The circulation patterns that are normal, the high pressure and low pressure, are completely mixed up. And we're heading towards extremes. And these extremes are definitely what we do not want.
So what can be done then to get us past this sort of smug ignorance that's displayed by the deniers and that's echoed by many, including the weather people on television, who seem to be cast largely because of their tight sweaters and cute appearance as opposed to their knowledge of, well, of course, the weather and climate are somewhat different things.
But nevertheless, you're right. It used to be that all weather people, all meteorologists went through a really intensive course in college. I mean, it's extremely difficult because of the high mathematics needed. But on the other hand, what we're seeing now, too, is that politicians are almost universally lawyers. To get a law degree, you need little if any science. And so the great tragedy of our time is that we are giving the power to really understand science and continue science to people who know nothing about science. And it is, we're reaping that benefit, if you will, right now.
So give us a sense then of how the fact that the Australian outback is getting so hot that it's even too hot for human existence on the one hand, and Atlanta being hit by a catastrophic ice storm.
Well, certainly weather itself is made up of great circulation patterns in the atmosphere. The planet is heating not in a very symmetrical fashion. The poles are heating much faster than the equator is. Near the equator, because of physics of atmosphere, you can't warm up more than a few degrees, but we know completely well now that the Arctic has been warming to the point that pack ice is disappearing. So once you've changed that differential, you're producing high pressure and low pressure cells that are unlike anything we've seen in the recent past. And just because we have a small cold spot, unfortunately for us, that small cold spot is the southeastern United States. And so it seems like the whole world is the United States. You just go anywhere else and you see that, in fact, the world is way warmer. And this warming is causing these extremes of heat. It's so hot in Australia that the kangaroos are dying.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Ward, who's a paleontologist who teaches biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. He has published widely on biodiversity and the fossil record and is an expert on mass extinctions. His award-winning books include Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere, and Under a Green Sky, which pointed out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought on by climate change, the same global warming that occurs today. His latest book is The Flooded Earth, Our Future on a World Without Ice Caps. And just let's touch on that idea of these major extinction events. What, there have been, what, five or six in history as much as we've recorded it?
Yes, there are five really big ones, and then there's another seven or eight more moderate extinction events. And in fact, it's very interesting that just today, one of my colleagues, Sam Bowering at the MIT, just came out with a new study showing how quickly the Permian extinction took place. This was the single greatest mass extinction of all time. It is not like the dinosaur killer where they die out quickly. So we didn't really know how long it would take, because this was completely what we call greenhouse extinction. It was brought about by volcanic activity putting a great deal of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The world then went through the stages that we're just starting now. The end result of this, of a carbon dioxide world above 2,000 parts per million, and remember we're at 400 and rising, is that ultimately the oceans themselves lose all their oxygen, and then a very nasty series of things happen. The bacteria that take over in a zero oxygen ocean produce hydrogen sulfide, very toxic, very poisonous as a consequence. And so the oceans began to fill hydrogen sulfide, and it finally went up into the atmosphere. Well, the Bowering study showed that the 90% extinction, the Permian extinction, took place over about 40 or 50,000 years. So this, again, is not like an asteroid hitting you, and that seems like an awful long time, but in fact it isn't. The fact that you almost made the world uninhabited by animals in that time span tells us that indeed we are ourselves possibly threatened by this. And once again, that world, the Permian world, and the other mass extinctions caused by greenhouse, which are the Triassic, Jurassic, we had one of the Cretaceous, we had one of the Devonian. So all of the mass extinctions except the dinosaur killer were caused by rapid rise of carbon dioxide. They were all volcanic. And yet even new work, our own work in Antarctica, has now shown that even the KT, the famous dinosaur killer, had within a component of global warming caused by a coincident big massive basalt flow, flood basalts they're called. So, I mean, to think that this can't happen again is naive. The first step, of course, is that you get warm enough that you lose all your ice caps, and we're certainly moving towards that right now.
So, but this is different in as much as it's the earlier extinctions were caused by volcanic disasters, etc. This is caused by human activity, is it not? Not that we are in an extinction yet, but we are heading towards it.
Well, carbon dioxide is carbon dioxide. I don't care where you get it. And the second aspect is that one of the most potent and effective of all greenhouse gases, these are the gases that warm, is water vapor. So you've got a positive feedback. As it gets warmer, more water vapor goes into the atmosphere, creating more greenhouse effect, creating more warming. And so we're on this conveyor belt now, and we are marching forward. I don't care where the CO2 comes from, volcanoes or Volvos, carbon dioxide is carbon dioxide. And the greatest single component is coal-fired plants. Last year, there was an estimate that China was putting up to 3 coal-fired plants in operation every week. Even if it were one a month, we really do see that this is leading us down the path. We must remove coal as an energy source. I have an ABC, anything but coal. It is the greatest single danger to not us so much, but to our future generations.
But my understanding, Peter Ward, is that the substitute for coal, which is being much touted now and coming online because of fracking natural gas, is in fact, they really haven't quantified the dangers of how much leakage is coming from the fracking process, and they haven't quantified how much leakage goes on in the entire gas grid all the way up into your house. How many times have you smelt gas somewhere? So there's constant leaking, and when you leak natural gas into the atmosphere, it's methane, which is one of the most destructive of global warming gases. So until we quantify how much methane is leaking from the increased use of natural gas, we don't know whether the advantage of burning natural gas over coal are worth it.
Well, that's completely right. We do know what is clean energy, and that comes from, to some extent, hydroelectric, but better yet is wind energy and, of course, solar energy. One of the great fights taking place in the Southwest right now is pitting environmentalist against environmentalist. There's a really sad irony here. If big areas of the Arizona desert were covered with gigantic solar cells, you could produce an appreciable amount of energy needed for the big cities nearby. I mean, we're talking about square miles of solar cells. And yet what that does, it puts the desert underneath it into total shade. That has a huge effect on the species that are there. And right now, the longevity or the existence of one or two lizards and turtles has been sufficient to stop any of this solar power. Look, we're at a state where we're going to need triage. There are going to have to be terrible decisions made. But in the long run, it's the lizards and the turtles are going to be far better off if we have as much solar power as possible.
And what's the chance of this wake-up happening? Because the lobby for natural gas is huge now. The president is touting our energy independence as a result of all of this fracking. I think we're going through a period of dangerous delusion and solar and wind, they keep saying it's the energy of the future. And as long as they keep saying it's the energy of the future, it will be the energy of the future. Until you build the very solar plant that you're talking about, a massive solar plant that powers major cities and proves once and for all that it can be done, which we've known that for decades that it could be done, we're not going to get anywhere.
No, unfortunately, I don't want to be a cynic. And if you take the tack that it's inevitable, then people just are given permission to do nothing. I mean, that's really not the case. We have to elect politicians smartly. The problem you just pointed out, however, is really true. The politicians do not want to make these hard choices. Cheap energy is this fool's gold that really trickles through our fingers. There's not going to be cheap energy. The alternative is a really rapid onset of global conditions that will make certain places uninhabitable and will certainly cause the ice sheets to melt to the point that a great deal of human food is covered by seawater. The melting ice sheets is, to me, the greatest single danger because we barely feed our 7 billion people now, or 6.5 billion, and unfortunately, if we cover up even a 3-foot to 5-foot area that is now down low, that you're talking about the rice fields and especially the big deltas, have that covered by seawater, and you've lost a very significant percentage of human agriculture. And yet it won't stop at 3 feet. If we continue, and we are continuing, there has never been ice sheets when we are at 1,000 parts per million. And we will be there at the latest 200 years from now, whereas a lot of people are thinking, in fact, only 100 years from now.
So what's your sense then of how much time we've got before we reach the point of no return? Because, as you pointed out, there are all of these reinforcing feedback loops. You know, for example, melting the tundra releases all the methane and so on.
Well, I see us actually in phase two now. This is the scary part. All of a sudden, these crazy weather patterns are becoming the norm. I mean, no longer do you say, gee, the weather is different this year. It's like, wow, the weather is crazy this year. Well, that's normal. So we're into that pattern. And we're going to see, unfortunately, what agriculture needs is complete predictability of seasons. When you start producing cold when it should be hot, dry when it should be warm, wet when it should be dry, when you stop putting snow in the mountains like the Sierras, California is the great breadbasket, agricultural, vegetable, fruit basket of America, and yet it depends entirely on being able to tap water sources that are stored as snow in the Sierras. They've got to irrigate out of these snow areas, and yet the snow level in the Sierras is coming to the point, is going up so high that they're losing water. So this is a very dire aspect.
So, Peter Ward, then, just in closing, you had mentioned earlier when we spoke that you were going to Australia to do research there on how devastating climate change has been to Australia. What can we learn from that? They seem to be, in many ways, the first in the front line of disaster with all the bushfires. And there's vast parts of the interior where a human being simply cannot live anymore, and the kangaroos are dying. That would seem to be a real beginning of the end.
Well, it is, but it isn't. And the reason I've chosen to go to Australia, and actually it might be for the rest of my life, I have a university position there, is that I think the people there are better set up to accept facts coming from scientists. It's a well-read, it's a very sophisticated population compared to ours in many ways. And my hope is that I can actually make a difference in at least one place. I just feel like a lot of us are banging our head against the wall in North America right now. Scientists, unfortunately, even the universities have set things up so that scientists are not really allowed for outreach. If you write popular books or articles in the tenure process in the leading American universities, that does not get you any brownie points towards tenure, but just the opposite. So outreach, the things that I do, that is left for the senior scientists. It should be the completely opposite. We should require that every junior scientist going for tenure is writing for the public as well as for his or her colleagues.
Well, but the new Prime Minister of Australia is a global warming denier. I mean, that's not a – and he's a Tea Party guy. And he may be an anomaly, but he's going to be in there for a while.
Well, I think he is going to be in there for a while, but he's also going to see his power cut off. Look, we know that any political system goes through zigs and zags. Look at Canada. They've had Stephen Harper for a while, and he's actually a very, very right-wing guy. But gradually, what happens is that these people get undercut, and the realization of what climate is doing and how it is changing is becoming so much in our face that denial increasingly will be impossible. And again, there's a place, I think, a smaller population, and I'm just going to give a try of seeing how they would respond to an American coming and helping others. There's so many down there talking about climate.
Well, Peter Ward, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Ward, who's a paleontologist who teaches biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington. He has published widely on biodiversity and fossil records and is an expert on mass extinctions. His award-winning books include Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere, and Under a Green Sky, pointed out that all but one of the major extinction events in history have been brought on by climate change, the same global warming that occurs today. His latest book is The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with the author of a new book that reads like a nail-biting thriller, but is in fact a definitive account of the ongoing Fukushima disaster.
The atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia, and whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Lochbaum, one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power. He formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now serves as director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And he is the co-author of the new book just out, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Lochbaum.
Thank you, Ian, for having me on.
And on March the 11th of 2011, this extraordinary 1-2 punch happened with a magnitude 9 earthquake, which was a natural disaster, but then it triggered a man-made disaster, causing the Fukushima Daiichi's 6 boiling water reactors to lose off-site electric power as the 50-foot tsunami crashed in and knocked out the backup diesel generators. And then a series of disasters unfolded over the days and continue to this day, do they not?
Well, the cleanup from the disasters definitely continue to this day and will for many years into the future.
And what is the sense of what the real legacy of this is? Because here in California, for example, we just learned that they're testing the kelp beds in the oceans off Malibu, California, for radiation from Fukushima.
Yeah, there were 3 reactor cores that melted down at Fukushima, and while much of that radioactivity that was released was contained within the thick concrete walls that surround the reactor vessels, because of various problems, quite a bit of that radiation was released to the air and water. So the ocean currents carried it across the Pacific, and the air currents carried it to China and even to the Aleutian Islands. So it was detected around the world, even though it was largely a local problem in terms of people having to evacuate and contaminated lands that will remain for decades.
So it's presumably the people on the land near the Fukushima Daiichi plants, they're the ones that are suffering the most.
Yes. To this day, almost 3 years after the event, there are tens of thousands of people who can't go home, or their homes are contaminated to levels that they'll probably never be able to return to those lands. So they're dislocated. And that problem will continue into the future as rainfall washes radiation from places today to different places tomorrow. Also, some of the radiation will be absorbed by plants and shrubbery and trees, and in the future, fires will free up that radioactivity to once again circulate far and wide.
So the more we talk about this, the more one gets the feeling that, you know, ever since the nuclear age, we've been playing with fire, and there's sort of a Faustian bargain, is there not, here with nuclear power. I mean, obviously, going back to Einstein and other physicists, the notion of a uncontrolled nuclear chain reaction, which is a nuclear bomb, was always considered sort of bad physics, I guess, and the trick has always been to do a controlled reaction. But that in itself is not necessarily under control.
Well, nuclear power has a lot of advantages, and there's also some thorns on that nuclear rose that, if not properly managed, can cause a lot of problems, as they did at Fukushima and they did at Chernobyl in 86 and so on. The advantage of nuclear power is you get an awful lot of energy from a small amount of material, whether it's the warhead of a bomb or the engine of a nuclear power plant. The downside is if you don't handle that right, that small amount of material can cause quite a bit of harm. And that's the other aspect of nuclear power is that you know, 80% is not a passing grade. You have to be right all the time. I remember reading in the Wall Street Journal 5 years after the Chernobyl accident that the cleanup from that one accident outweighed the economic benefits from dozens of reactors that had operated in the former Soviet Union for decades up till that accident. So there was one bad day at one plant wiped out benefits accrued over decades from dozens of other plants. And that not many other technologies have that risk-reward profile.
Well, my understanding is that Admiral Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy, and after all, it was the nuclear reactor that propelled the submarines that were scaled up to become the basis of these nuclear power plants, these light water reactors. And Rickover, apparently, to this day, the U.S. Navy isn't allowed to bring its nuclear-powered fleet into some of the big ports. And Rickover always believed that nuclear power was so dangerous in the sense that you've just described, that you either have to have 100% certainty nothing happens, but when something does, it outweighs the benefits because of the catastrophic nature of a meltdown. He felt that civilian nuclear power should be under the control of the military because only military discipline would be sufficient to contain the beast, if you will. Is that your understanding?
Exactly. Both of my parents worked for the Westinghouse Electric Corporation, who had contracts with Admiral Rickover, and both have told me stories about dealings with the Admiral. One of the advantages that Admiral Rickover had that you alluded to was the military didn't have to worry about the bottom line or the profit margins as much. You know, they had a job to do, and as long as he went to Congress and got funded, he could instill that discipline and mandate high standards that everybody had to meet. When you go to the civilian nuclear power, particularly in an open marketplace where you're competing with non-nuclear sources of electricity, the bottom line becomes more and more important and becomes more and more tempting to take some safety shortcuts so that you can remain profitable. So it is, Admiral Rickover felt that in order to best control that temptation, take it out of the hands of the private industry and keep it in government control.
And you wrote this book along with your colleague at the Union of Concerned Scientists, the physicist Edwin Lyman, and Susan Stranathan, who was a lead reporter on the Philadelphia Inquirer's Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. And this book that you've written that's just out now really sort of reads like a thriller. It's quite disturbing and gripping at the same time. The story of trying to contain this accident as it unfolds and the lack of information that was coming forth from the Japanese company TEPCO is pretty extraordinary. And to this day, what assurances do we have that we know the full story, given the cozy relationship that the regulators and the power plants had in Japan, which somewhat mirrors the relationship we have here in this country between nuclear power plants and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which you recently worked on?
Yeah, I think the relationship between the company TEPCO in Japan and the regulator is less of a factor than the radiation and the widespread damage that was done is basically preventing a CSI nuclear, if you will. It's difficult to get into certain areas to figure out what happened, what damage was caused by the earthquake, what damage was caused by the tsunami, what damage was caused by the hydrogen explosions, and so on, because many areas of the plant still can't be entered by humans today, at least not except by suicide missions. So they're using remote-controlled vehicles and drones and cameras on fiber-optic cables to try to look into areas that people can't go. And so, therefore, the full story of what happened and why is not known because it's just not knowable for many years into the future. We do know some things today that we didn't know right in the immediate days and weeks after the accident because of samples of water that were taken and so on that helped give more insights. It's basically like a jigsaw puzzle. We have turned over some of the pieces, so we're starting to see a picture, but there's many pieces yet to be turned over to get the full story.
But the drama of the story is rather like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is the nature of a meltdown, right? That you've got to contain this runaway extreme heat, and they just poured all of this water and all of this seawater on it. And we don't quite know the full tally of that, do we? And it's still, today, they keep pouring more water on it, don't they? These cores haven't really cooled yet, have they?
Well, they've cooled a little bit, and they have more margin than they definitely had 2.5 years ago, but there's still a need to continue to circulate water through the reactor cores to prevent even further damage. One of the things that was interesting to me in doing the research for the book was the many challenges that the workers had in dealing with that. The ultimate irony of being right next to the Pacific Ocean and having three reactor cores melt down because you couldn't get water to them is tragic and ironic. the other problem the workers had was that they had a number of pumps, a number of things that they might have been able to employ to get water into the reactor vessels and prevent that outcome. But there was darkness because of the loss of power. They were, in many places, they were wading through 18 to 24 inches of water in darkness. The earthquake and tsunami had lifted some manholes out of their place, so they ran a risk of stepping into an open manhole and drowning. And there were also many, many aftershocks after the big quake. So they were, and then they had three explosions at the site due to hydrogen that they were definitely not prepared for. So they were very heroes in taking the actions they did. In addition to the threats they faced at the plant site, it was also revealing to note that they had families at home who sometimes they didn't know if they'd survived the earthquake and tsunami or were being properly cared for. So they had all the problems facing them at work coupled with just unimaginable problems at home, and that I wouldn't have wanted to trade shoes with any of them.
Well, of course, that's one of the ironies that I think people have a hard time getting their heads around with nuclear power, is that the nuclear power plant depends so much upon electricity, backup electricity, off-site electricity.
Yeah, that's that was, at least within the industry, that's been known for years. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the 80s analyzed a scenario very similar to what happened at Fukushima with complete loss of power. And the Fukushima accident followed that timeline, not quite to the minute, but it pretty much followed that script that had been written back in the 80s. So it was known that if you lose power to a nuclear power plant, you've only got minutes to hours to undo that problem before things get very, very bad. And unfortunately, even though Fukushima had those hours, there were so many complications that the workers or those heroes were unable to save the day. They prevented much worse, but they were unable to prevent three reactor cores from melting down.
And just to get a sense of, you mentioned the extraordinary nature of this disaster, how still there's so much of this plant that you can't get near, and they're still pouring water in all the time to cool it down and trying to store that water. And so much of, during the emergency, all that water went out into the ocean, and right offshore was the USS Ronald Reagan, this big nuclear-powered aircraft carrier that was whose drinking water and showering water comes from a desalinization plant aboard that was sucking up all of this contaminated water. So even the rescuers were contaminated, but nothing like the 80,000 people who have been displaced, and the cost of the cleanup and victim compensation is apparently going to be at least $125 billion. And on top of that, Japan's economy, apparently, its a whole economic recovery is in jeopardy because of the tremendous balance of payments problems they have with importing a record amount of natural liquefied gas to make up for the loss of these nuclear power plants. Last year, that cost the Japanese $69 billion. So this is an ongoing disaster. And when you say, you know, you've got to factor in the benefits of nuclear power as opposed to the downside if something goes wrong, I mean, I'm just factoring in more of the downside there. It seems almost endless.
Well, it's not endless, but it is a very long path. I mean, they're going to ring up a lot of cash registers for many decades because the costs are enormous. If you don't get it right, the costs are enormous. If you do get it right, the benefits are enormous too. I mean, that's the reason people keep trying this, is that if you get it right, the benefits from, you know, the footprint. For my mother's family came from West Virginia, where coal mining has caused some problems over the years. But the environmental footprint from nuclear power, the amount of fuel that you need, the material you need is so small that if you get it right, you get a lot of benefits. But if you get it wrong one day, you can seriously undermine all those benefits from all that time. So the trick is to, as Admiral Rickover strove to achieve, was to derive the benefits from this technology without incurring its downsides, even once.
But the fact that we have to depend upon an industry to get it right 100% of the time, that is in itself, apparently, just like the Japanese industry, too cozy a relationship with its regulators. And you work for the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and my understanding is that they still haven't implemented much of the task force that was set up to learn from the Fukushima accident in terms of light water reactors here in the United States. I think, 23 of them that are identical to the ones that melted down in Japan?
And there are 23 that are very identical, but the 100 reactors that we have operating today in the United States, if any of those had been in Fukushima's place at that time, the outcome would have been the same. None of our plants are designed to endure that kind of challenge. So Japan wasn't different from us in that regard. We had better luck than they did, but it wasn't that there was a Japanese fault. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to its credit, does frequently take actions to prevent plants from being safer. For example, in late 2010, before Fukushima happened, the NRC identified some problems with flood protection at the Fort Calhoun plant in Nebraska, and they made that owner upgrade those flood protection measures. In June of 2011, the Missouri River flooded, and actually that plant became an island in the Missouri River for about 2 weeks. So the NRC's actions about 6 months earlier made that plant much better prepared for the challenge it faced that June. So the NRC is not always a lapdog, not always a some people say that NRC is the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Committee. It's not, they have at times enforced regulations. Our concern with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is consistent enforcement. It's one thing to have high standards that protect, don't reduce the risk to zero, but reduce it to an acceptably low level. But when you set the safety bar and then watch plants limbo beneath it, that's just inviting disaster.
Well, what's happening then at the Millstone Power Station in New London, Connecticut? It's supposedly trying to upgrade to put on a storage dome to contain a Fukushima-type disaster?
Yeah, Millstone, one of the orders that the NRC issued plant owners to undertake a year after the Fukushima accident was to better prepare for bad days like that caused by acts of nature. Millstone is spending approximately $10 million for a hardened building that will store portable pumps and portable generators that could be used if something takes out the normal array of equipment, such as the tsunami at Fukushima. In that eventuality, workers will enter that building, move that portable generators, portable pumps, in order to provide cooling water from the ocean, in Millstone's case, into the reactor cores to prevent it becoming the next Fukushima. The oddity about that hardened building is that it's one of the purposes for this building is in case of a severe earthquake, workers are supposed to be able to go in that building and use that equipment to save the day. But the building's not being designed for severe earthquakes. It's being designed for modest earthquakes. So, and that's because its owner can't justify to the board of directors to spend the money to have a more robust, more hardened building. The NRC is accepting less, so that's what they're paying for. So in some respects, it's a safety net, but it's made out of twine instead of stronger rope.
Well, David Luckbaum, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate the time.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.